When you think about Thomas Jefferson as an artist, as a writer, and as a president and statesman, we don't think anything strangely about that, the founders of our country being hot-headed people like Patrick Henry and who wrote. And we don't have any problems with that. And yet today we seem to focus on images. Yes, the arts have also appeared in our presidency recently. Ronald Reagan as an actor. But somehow for me, the reason that Ronald Reagan was elected had more to do with his ability to act, to be a presidential figure, which our country needed. And that's why he was elected, because the people seemed to feel that need to elect this image. But we somehow think, and I think if your mindset is like mine, the thinking in the government happens someplace else. And the president says yay or nay, but doesn't really become that, provide the kind of moral leadership or the kind of philosophical leadership that happens in other places. I don't know, maybe it might just be good to get some of your thinking about Czechoslovakia and how much you know about Czechoslovakia, both as the country and the government and its historical background, just so we can sort of all be talking on the same grounds. Maybe, what do you know about Czechoslovakia? Where is it? You know where it lies? It's actually right in the center of Europe. It's probably one of those, and it's only 191 miles wide from north to south, which is really, when you think about it, is pretty tiny. And then it has a great width from east to west, so it really stretches into what are socialist or communist countries, and it also borders with Germany, with Austria, with Poland, with Hungary. So you've got a lot of mixtures of cultures and types of people. It's always been a Slavic country, along with the other Slavic countries. But it also, like Switzerland, has been sort of the trade routes, with people crossing through all the time. So you get a lot of influx from a lot of different cultures and a lot of different ideas coming through. Czechoslovakia, as we know it today, is primarily the result of World War II. Does anybody know what happened in Czechoslovakia in World War II, or prior to World War II?
Well, the Germans moved in.
Yeah, in Sudetenland, which had generally a German-speaking population. And which is one of the reasons that Hitler moved in, because he said, these are really German people anyway, so I'll just move in.
Were they the first country? It seems to me they were.
No, Poland was the first country.
Poland was first, but the Sudetenland was used as the real justification for the movement. It was sort of saying, they're one of our people, so we have the right to move in. Kuwait, anyone? But it was that kind of justification. Yes.
Actually, Czechoslovakia was absorbed before Hitler attacked Poland, probably in 1937-38, and then Hitler attacked Poland in 39. That's what actually started the war.
But he
already had Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, Czechoslovakia was already in. Then after World War II, of course, it became part of the Eastern Bloc countries, and as part of the settlement became part of the Soviet Union, and had from 1948 on was the Socialist Soviet Republic of Czechoslovakia, the Socialist Republic of Czechoslovakia. Another bellwether year, or probably the other year that is most familiar with people in Czechoslovakia's history, is 1968. Anybody remember Czechoslovakia in 1968.
Was that when the tanks moved in?
Yeah. It really was a movement, a political movement that happened in the mid-60s, which was basically what's happening now in many of Eastern European countries. There was a freeing of trade, an opening of free enterprise, a lifting of freedoms and individual rights, and people, and it sort of culminated in what was called the Prague Spring, the spring of 1968, under the Dubček government. And there were great, great amounts of freedoms when suddenly, one night, the Soviets rolled their tanks through the streets of Prague, and that was the end of that, and the lid was clamped down on Czechoslovakia. The reason I'm talking and pointing up 1968, because it's very important in sort of the history of Václav Havel and World War II and the 60s influenced the writings of Václav Havel and sort of shaped his political philosophy and his individual philosophy. Václav Havel was born in 1936, prior to the war. He was the son of a well-to-do engineer, upper middle class, if not upper class. Well, what happened immediately in 1948, suddenly he was a child of the enemy of the state, because his family was upper class bourgeois, and the communists immediately took all property away and disallowed any of his former rights, basically. And one of those major rights was denying him the right to go to school. And so he didn't have formal study as such. He studied by himself. He was a lab technician for a while. One of the plays we're going to be reading scenes from tonight includes scenes that take place in scientific laboratories, so he's very familiar with the scientific rigid approach to things. He also served 2 years in the army, so he was very used to the militaristic view of things, especially as it was presented. As he started reading more and more, and as he became involved, he began writing, and he began writing first short articles. We have a record of a speech he made in 1955 that got him into a little bit of trouble, even then, because it was highly critical of over-regimentation. In 1959, he, like those of us in theater, somehow were seduced by the stage, and since that time, he primarily, other than being a politician, has been associated with stage, and most of his writings have been theatrical writings because he loved the idea of characters. I put a quote on the board that is Václav Havel's statement about himself when asked why he became the president and how he feels about himself the president. And in this is the essence of how he feels about theater, too. The real test of a man is not how well he plays the role he has invented for himself, but how he plays the role destiny assigned to him. And he really believes that. He really believes in his own destiny kind of motivating. Václav Havel is a man of great paradox, and we're going to see a lot of that paradox in his writing. In the early 60s, he was influenced by a number of theatrical writers, mostly absurdist writers, writers from the West. If you recognize the name Ionesco or Beckett, who are two theatrical writers who are known for plays that use language as kind of a weapon to talk about the absurdity of life. And they use and they emphasize the fact that language by itself is absurd. And we're going to, with the help tonight of Robert and Jan Nairn, we're going to be reading a couple of scenes. And the first scene I'd like to read tonight is from one of his early plays. It was written about 1965. It's called The Memorandum. And the play basically takes place in an office complex, and it emphasizes how far bureaucracy can go. And some of us may recognize this if we ever worked in offices, because the whole basis of the play is a memorandum. And this company decides that memoranda are confusing as they're sent around. So they set out to develop a language that will clarify all terms so the memorandum can be sent and there can be no confusion about the memorandum because all the words are very carefully spelled out. And the problem with this is that it takes forever to learn the new language that they create, and once you do learn it, it's impossible to use. Robert will read this particular scene is a classroom in which this language is being taught, and now I present the teacher, Mr. Lear.
Pisidepi, as you know, is a synthetic language built on a strictly scientific basis. Its grammar is constructed with maximum rationality. Its vocabulary is unusually broad. It is thoroughly exact language, capable of expressing with far greater precision than any current natural tongue all the minutest nuances in the formulation of important office documents. The result of this precision is, of course, the exceptional complexity and difficulty of Pididepi. There are many months of intensive study ahead of you, which can be crowned by success only if it is accompanied by diligence, perseverance, discipline, talent, and a good memory. And, of course, by faith. Without steadfast faith in Pididepi, nobody yet has ever been able to learn Pididepi. And now, let us turn briefly to some of the basic principles of Pididepi. The natural language has originated, as we know, spontaneously, uncontrollably, in other words, unscientifically, and their structure is thus, in a certain sense, dilettantish. As far as official communications are concerned, the most serious deficiency of natural languages is their utter unreliability, which results from the fact that their basic structural units, words, are highly equivocal and interchangeable. You all know that in natural language, it is often enough to exchange one letter for another. Goat, boat, love, dove, or simply remove one letter, fox, ox, and the whole meaning of the word is thus changed. And then there are all the homonyms. Consider what terrible mischief can be caused in inter-office communications when two words with entirely different meanings are spelled exactly the same way. P-O-S-S-U-M. Possum or possum? The first designating an American small arboreal or aquatic, or aquatic nocturnal marsupial mammal with thumbed hind foot. The second and Latin equivalent of I am able. Such a thing is quite unthinkable in Pididepi. The significant aim of Pididepi is to guarantee to every statement by purposefully limiting all similarities between individual words a degree of precision, reliability, and lack of equivocation quite unattainable in natural language. To achieve this, Pididepi makes use of the following postulation. If similarities between any two words is to be minimized, the words must be formed by the least probable combination of letters. This means that the creation of words must be based on such principles as would lead to the greatest possible redundancy of language. You see, a redundancy, in other words, the difference between the maximum and the real entropy, related to the maximum entropy and the expressed percentually, concerns precisely that superfluity by which the expression of a particular piece of information in a given language is longer and less probable. i.e. less likely to appear in this particular form, than would be the same expression in a language in which all the letters have the same probability of occurrence. Briefly, the greater the redundancy of a language, the more reliable it is, because the smaller is the possibility that by exchange of a letter, by an oversight or a typing error, the meaning of the text could be altered. How does, in fact, Pitadepi achieve its high redundancy? By consistent use of the so-called principle of 60% dissimilarity. Which means that any Pitadepi word must differ by at least 60% of its letters from any other Pitadepi word of the same length. And incidentally, any part of such word must differ in the same way from any Pitadepi word of this length. That is, from any word shorter than is the one of which it is a part. Thus, for example, out of the possible five-letter combinations of the 26 letters of our alphabet, and these are 11,881,376, only 432 combinations can be found which differ from each other by three letters. For example, by 60% of the total. From these 432 combinations, only 17 fulfill the other requirements as well, and thus have become Pitadepi words. Hence, it is clear that in Pitadepi, there often occur words which are very long indeed. Yes?
Would you please tell us which is the longest word in Pitadepi?
Certainly. It is the word meaning a wombat, which has 319 letters. But let us proceed. Naturally, this raises the question of how Pitadepi solves the problem of manageability and pronounceability of such long words. Quite simply, inside these words, the letters are interspersed with occasional gaps, so that a word may consist of a greater or smaller number of the so-called subwords. But at the same time, the length of a word, as indeed everything in Pitadepi, is not left to chance. You see, the vocabulary of Pitadepi is built according to an entirely logical principle. The more common the meaning, the shorter the word. Thus, for example, the most commonly used term so far known, that is the term whatever, is rendered in Pitadepi by the word g. As you can see, it is a word consisting of only two letters. There exists, however, an even shorter word, that is, but this word does not yet carry any meaning. I wonder if any of you can tell me why. Well, Mr. Thumb.
It's being held in reserve in case science should discover a term even more commonly used than the term whatever.
Correct, Mr. Thumb. You get an A.
Okay.
Now, I think you can see that one of the gifts that Vaclav Havel has is a wonderful sense of humor and a real sense and love for language. And he really plays a lot with language and humor. When you study Havel's work, you become aware of a lot of the paradox in the man and the paradox in his work. Because he is a president and a playwright. Several months before he became president, everybody thought he was going to prison yet again. He was a prisoner and a president. He writes about very serious subjects, which contain a lot of heavy topics that cause people a lot of hurt, but he approaches them quite often with a great deal of humor, and that mixture, sometimes very dark humor, very black humor, almost gallows humor, which he in his own writings talks about as being one of the essential ingredients of oppressed people, that oppressed people use dark humor to get through their situation, the worst situations. I think we can all remember situations in our lives that have been really, really horrible and drastic, and in the midst of those situations, you'll come up with the most black, is the blackest joke or the blackest, darkest comment, and other people may look at you really askance because they can't believe in your situation you're making jokes about it. But we all know, I think, that humor is one of the ways of cutting through that oppression. And Havel was very connected to that a lot in a lot of his writings. Between 1956 and 1968, every year Havel delivered speeches highly critical of the government for the Czech Writers Association. Many of these speeches were published internationally. And his plays also began to be published internationally. The Memorandum was probably his most famous play of the time. In 1967, it received a production by Joe Papp's theater in New York City. It was regarded as a strong example of absurdist theater and critical of bureaucracy and traditional ways of organizing society. He also began to be noticed a lot by the powers that be. In 1968, in 1967, he and three other Czech writers became members of, I'm sorry, in 1977, as after the Dubček regime had really repressed a lot of the writers, and many of his works were only seen in the West and could only be published in the West, he and several other Czech writers became members of a group that called themselves Charter 77, which was an organization that officially sent letters to the government protesting the lack of freedom in the country. He also formed the Civic Forum in Prague, which was part of another organization, which was the Public Against Violence organization, which were made up of environmentalists, theater artists, and other writers and journalists trying to put some pressure on the government. Obviously, during this time, he was criticized and obviously spent some time in prison. One of the plays that came out during this particular period was a play called Temptation. Temptation is a play based upon the Dr. Faust legend, or the Faust legend. I don't know if you know or are familiar with the Faust legend, but basically Faust makes a pact with the devil and sells his soul to the devil for immediate gain, for wealth, for love, for all the temporal things in society, and because he makes that pact with the devil, then loses his soul. And it's an ancient story, a medieval story. In this particular version of the Faust story, Havel places it in, again, a scientific institute. He seemed to love to attack science because he felt that science always was used by government to rationally explain why things were as they were and why they had to be as they were. Of course, we don't think that anymore, but in this play, his leading character, Dr. Faustka works in a science laboratory. And the director of the science laboratory is constantly tantalizing him by offering him things But nothing ever really happens. One of the attributes of a theater of the absurd play is that it becomes very circular. People come and say the same things and do the same actions over and over and over and over and over again. This particular scientific institute that he's attached to is given the responsibility by the government to protect the government against the metaphysical and things that people don't know about, like religion, like anything that is based upon superstition. And their job is to study these elements so that they can suppress them and keep society functioning in the way it should be functioning. In the scenes we're going to read, with the help of Robert and Jan, we're going to introduce you to Dr. Fauska's first connection with Mr. Fistula, who you'll see comes to represent Mephistopheles, the devil, what you will. I'll be reading Dr. Fauska. Jan will read Mrs. Hobaba and the director, and Robert will be reading, guess who, Fistula. Okay. The play begins with Fauska in a dressing gown, kneeling in the middle of the room with four burning candles on the floor around him. He holds a fifth one in his left hand and a piece of chalk in his right hand, with which he draws a circle around himself and the four candles.
A large old volume lies open on the floor beside him. The room is dimly lit. When Fauska completes his circle, he glances at the book and studies something in it for a while. Then he shakes his head and mumbles something. At that moment, someone knocks at the door. Fauska is startled and jumps to his feet.
Just a minute! Who is it?
It's me, Professor.
Come in, Mr. Hobaba.
It's really smoky in here. You ought to air the place out.
I will, right away. Did something happen?
You have a visitor.
Me? Who?
I don't know. He didn't introduce himself.
So it's someone you don't know?
Well, he hasn't been here before. At least I've never seen him.
What does he look like?
Well, how can I put it? A little seedy, and mainly, well...
What?
It's embarrassing.
Just say it, Mrs. Hobo.
Well, he simply smells.
Really? But how?
Well, it's hard to describe. Sort of like Limburger cheese.
My word. Well, never mind. Show him in.
This way, please.
Fistula enters. He's a smallish person, almost a dwarf, limping and giving off a distinctly unsavory impression. He holds a paper bag containing his slippers. Hobova casts a final glance after him, shrugs at Fauska, and exits, closing the door behind her. Fistula is grinning stupidly. Good evening.
Greetings! What a cozy place you have here, just as I'd imagined it. Good books, a rare globe, everything somehow as it ought to be. The balances don't lie.
I don't know what balances you're talking about. But first of all, I don't know who I'm speaking to.
All in good time. May I sit down?
Please.
I assume that I don't have to ask you not to mention my visit to anyone. For your sake as well as mine.
Why shouldn't I mention it?
You'll see why soon enough. My name is Fistula. Where I'm employed is of no importance, and in any event, I don't even have a permanent position. Nor do I need to have one, since I'm a cripple with a pension.
I guess that from the smell you work in a safety match factory.
That comes from a certain unidentified fungus of the foot. It makes me quite miserable, and I do what I can for it, even though there's not much I can do. Aren't you going to ask me what I want, or why I've come?
I'm ever hopeful that you'll tell me that yourself.
And that, of course, would be quite impossible. But I had a particular reason for not doing it until now.
What was it?
I was interested to see whether you'd figure it out for yourself.
How could I figure it out when I've never seen you before in my life? In any case, I have neither the time nor the inclination to play guessing games with you. Unlike you, I happen to have a job, and I'm leaving in a few minutes...
For the office party, right? But you've got heaps of time for that.
How do you know I'm going to an office party?
And before my arrival, you weren't exactly behaving like someone in a hurry, either.
You don't know a thing about what I was doing before your arrival.
I beg your pardon. But I certainly know better than you do that I know, and what I know, and what I don't know, and how I know what
look,
I know.
Look, Mr.
Fistula.
Look, Mr. Fistula, I'm asking you plainly and simply, in all seriousness, and I'm expecting a plain and simple, serious answer from you. What do you want?
Does the name Marbwell say anything to you? Or Lauderdale? Or Lafield?
Out!
Excuse me.
I said out.
What do you mean out?
Leave my apartment immediately and never set foot in it again.
Did you hear me?
I heard you clearly, and I'm delighted by this
reaction of yours, because it absolutely confirms that I've come to the right place.
What do you mean?
Your fright, don't you see, makes it perfectly clear that you're fully aware of the importance of my contacts. Which you wouldn't be if you hadn't been interested in the aforementioned powers earlier.
Those names don't mean a thing to me. I haven't the faintest idea of what you're talking about. Moreover, the suddenness of my demand that you leave merely reflected the suddenness with which I became fed up with you. My disgust coming at the same time that you pronounced those names was a complete coincidence. And now, having given you this explanation, I can only repeat what I said before, but this time without any fear that you might mistake my meaning. Leave my apartment immediately and never set foot in it again.
Ah, your first request for me to leave, that I'll naturally grant, though probably not quite immediately. Your second request I will not grant, for which you will be very grateful to me later on.
You missed my meaning. Those weren't two independent requests. In fact, they weren't requests at all. It was a demand, a single and indivisible one at that.
I'll make a note of it. But I'd also like to point something out. The haste with which you slipped in an additional motivation for your demand, together with the interesting fact that even though you claimed to be fed up with me, you considered it important enough to slip in this additional motivation, even at the risk of delaying my longed-for departure. That haste, together with that interesting fact, are proof to me of one single thing, that your original fear of me as a middleman, for certain contexts, has now been superseded by a fear of me as a potential informer. Now, let me assure you, however, that I was counting on this phase as well. In fact, had it not set in, I would have felt quite uneasy. I would have considered it peculiar and would have wondered myself whether, in fact, you weren't an informer yourself. But now let me get down to business. There's obviously no way I can prove to you that I'm not an informer. Even if I were to conjure up Ariel himself at this moment, it still wouldn't eliminate the possibility of my being an informer. Therefore, you have only three choices. First, to consider me an informer and to continue to insist on my immediate departure. Second, not to consider me an informer and to trust me. Third, not to make up your mind for the time being as to whether I'm an informer or not, but to adopt a waiting attitude. Meaning, on the one hand, not to kick me out immediately, and on the other hand, not to say anything in front of me that you might eventually be used against you, if I actually were an informer. I'd like to recommend the third alternative.
Very well, I'll accept that. But I'd like to point out that there's obviously no need for me to control or restrict my speech in any way, because there's absolutely nothing I could possibly think, much less say, that might possibly be used against me.
Marvelous! You delight me. If I were an informer, I'd have to admit that you avoided the first trap beautifully. Your declaration is clear evidence of your absolute solid caution, intelligence, and quick wit. Qualities which I eagerly welcome, since they give me hope that I'll be able to depend on you and that we'll be able to work together well.
Listen, Mr.
Fistula.
Listen, Mr. Fistula, I'd like to tell you two things. First of all, your talk is a bit redundant for my taste. You really ought to get to the point of what brought you here more quickly. You've said virtually nothing, even though I asked you ages ago for a serious, direct, and concise answer to the question of what you actually want. And secondly, it surprises me greatly to hear that we're supposed to be working together on something. That requires two people, after all.
Your answer had 86 words. Considering its semantic value, that isn't exactly a small number. And if I were you, I wouldn't reproach anybody too severely for redundancy.
Bullshit is infectious, as we know.
I hope that as time goes by, you'll adopt some of my more important skills as well.
You actually want me to teach you something?
Not only to teach.
What else, for God's sake?
Leave him out of this.
Well, what else are you planning to do with me?
To initiate you.
Okay. We move. What the initiation turns out to be is that Dr. Fauska is interested in a young girl that works in his office, and Mr. Fistula arranges, supposedly, this connection at the party. We now go to another scene where Dr. Fausta comes back into his house only to find Fistula already there. What are you doing here?
I'm waiting for you.
How did you get in?
Not through the chimney, if that's what you're wondering. Through the door, which Mrs. Hubafa kindly opened for me before she went out shopping, because I explained to her how urgently you needed to speak to me and how hard it would be for me to wait for you outside with my lame foot.
So you tricked her. How like you. You're a devil, and I don't want to have anything to do with you.
You're missing the point again. If the devil exists, then above all, he exists within our own selves.
Then you, needless to say, must be his favorite residence.
Ah, you overestimate my value at least as much as you overestimated your own just a second ago. Think of it this way. I'm only a catalyst who helps his fellow creatures awaken or accelerate things that have long existed within themselves, even without his help. My help, you see, merely enables them to discover their own courage, to experience and enjoy something thrilling in life, and consequently to become more fulfilled themselves. We only live once. Why then should we spend these precious few decades that have been allotted to us stifling under the cover of some sort of Philistine scruples? Do you know why you called me a devil? In order to shift your own responsibility purely out of fear of your own scruples and of that thing within you that breaks them down, to a place outside of your own ego, in this case, onto me. And by means of this transference, as you scientists call it, or projection, to ease your conscience. You hope to fool your own scruples by using this kind of maneuver and by assigning me that insulting name you hoped would actually even please them. But think of it this way, Dr. Frauska. I, a certain cripple Fistula, wouldn't be able to move you an inch if you hadn't secretly dreamed about moving in that direction yourself long ago. Our little experiment had no other purpose than to clarify these little trivialities for you.
And what about your assurance that it was innocent? That was a dirty trick.
My dear friend.
I'm not your friend.
My dear sir, the truth isn't merely what should we believe, after all, but also why, and to whom, and under what circumstances we saw it. We see it. That one, overwhelms man with a multitude of unkeepable commandments, and therefore there's nothing left for him but to forgive occasionally. The others, on the other hand, liberate man from all those unkeepable commandments, and therefore, understandably, they are totally rid of the need, opportunity, and finally even the capacity to forgive. But even if that weren't so, they wouldn't be able to forgive the betrayal of the very agreement to releasing all that boundless freedom. Why, such forgiveness would make their entire world collapse. But really, might not the obligation to be faithful to the authority which gives us that sort of freedom actually be the only guarantee of freedom from all obligation? Do you see what I mean?
Okay. There are several words in there that are really important in the life of Vaclav Havel. One is the informer, and always always the fear, living in an oppressed society, that everyone you meet may inform on you and report you to the authorities, which could involve your imprisonment if you're doing the wrong thing and making the wrong practices. The other important word is the word that came at the end, if you listen to the last paragraph. Belief in God is equated with forgiveness. And if you remove that area of forgiveness, then it's possible to do anything and have complete control of society. And in this play, and that's why Havel was so dangerous in his own society, because he coded everything with a wonderfully comic character who represented the devil. What a better way to speak the truth than having the devil speak the truth. And the idea of forgiveness is part of what Havel really believes. One of the paradoxes of his presidency is that he has a strong moral backbone, but he is able to forgive. He is able to have strong ideals that he feels strongly about, but has the ability to forgive. This was his campaign slogan and appeared on posters all over Czechoslovakia with Havel's picture. Truth and love must prevail over lies and hatred. He's backed that up since he's been president. One of the first things he did as president is go to the hospital bed of a man, a communist leader, who was one of the severest of the oppressors who had attempted suicide. And he went to the hospital bed of that man and wished him well and hoped that he could recover soon and return to his life. Havel believes in truth as well, and he is tough on his people. We talked about Sudetenland for a while. After World War II, the Czechoslovakian people were especially harsh on all the Germans living in Sudetenland, and great number of atrocities were committed. One of the first things that Havel did is told his people that they must forgive the Germans for World War II and all the problems and all the times of trial that happened in the Sudetenland. He also was very truthful with his people by saying that they had to admit their own complacency and their own involvement in what happened in 1968. They had to forgive the Soviets. They could not say, this was the Soviets that moved in and took over the country. Why did the Czechoslovakian people let this happen? As part of one of the manifestos that was written, wrong book. Yeah, I think it's this one. No, maybe it is this one. One of the manifestos that was written by the committee, one of the committees that was involved in the revolution, has as part of the manifesto this following statement. Let's keep cool heads. We have to look for people with whom we have things in common, for allies rather than for enemies. Let's not judge people solely on ideological grounds as we were judged. We should not allow disqualification of people who are qualified and dissent only because they were not revolutionary enough or because they were slower to catch up. We need all capable people. The mass purges of the 1970s of so-called consolidation must not be repeated. And for me, there's great comfort in statements like that, and thinking that a government is headed by people who have those kind of ideas. It's very rough over there, and it's going to continue to be a very rough time for these emerging nations, because economically they're going to be struggling a long time, but there's a sense of freedom and openness. There's one other scene I'd like to, unfortunately, we're really short on time. I'm going to do another session on Saturday dealing with more plays from other countries that also influence this, and I also want to open discussion up, so if you are more interested in more of this idea, please come to my session on Saturday. But I'd like to finish today with a scene that for a long time Havel's plays were not published in Czechoslovakia. The only copies of Havel's plays you could get were outside of Czechoslovakia. But there were a number of underground press that published plays, and there were short plays, among them three short plays that were called the Vonick plays. And the Vonick plays sort of uses Havel as a character, only it's called Vonick. The character is called Vonick. And Vonick represents people who were in prison. In this scene from a play called Protest, Vonick goes to a friend of his who was a screenwriter. And this screenwriter was involved in the early days of Protest and Movement, but since then has become very rich and has done a lot of television shows which were government supported and so forth. And in this character, and the interesting thing about the play and what I want you to listen for is something that I was telling Robert and Jan today reminded me in a way of a lot of things that sometimes happen here at Holden as well. How easy it is to commit yourself by voice, and how difficult it is to commit yourself in actuality. And I want you to see if you can resonate with any of this. The character Stanek. Excuse me, Ferdinand, does the name Javorek mean anything to you?
Our pop bard? Ah, I know him very well.
So I expect you know what happened to him.
Of course. They locked him up for telling a story during one of his performances. The story about a policeman who meets a penguin in the street.
Ridiculous, isn't it? It was just an excuse, that's all. The fact is they hate his guts because he sings the way he does. Good Lord. The whole thing is so cruel, so ludicrous, so base.
And cowardly.
Right, and cowardly. Look, I've been trying to do something for the lad. I mean, I know a few chaps on the town council and at the prosecutor's office, but you know how it is. Promises, promises. They all say they're going to look into it, but the moment your back is turned, they drop it like a hot potato so they don't get their fingers burned. Sickening the way everybody looks out for the number one.
Still, I think it's nice of you to have tried to do something.
My dear Ferdinand, I'm really not the sort of man your friends obviously take me for. Some peanuts?
No, thank you.
About Javorek.
Yes.
Since I didn't manage to accomplish anything through private intervention, it occurred to me perhaps it ought to be handled in a somewhat different way. You know what I mean? Simply write something, a protest or a petition. In fact, this is the main thing I wanted to discuss with you. Naturally, you're far more experienced in these matters than I. If this document contains a few fairly well-known signatures, like yours, for example, it's bound to be published somewhere abroad, which might create some political pressure, right? I mean, these things don't seem to impress them all that much, actually, but honestly, I don't see any other way to help the lad. Not to mention Annie.
Annie?
My daughter.
Oh! Oh, is that your daughter?
That's right.
Well, what about her?
I thought you knew.
Knew what?
She's expecting by Javorek.
Oh, I see. That's why...
Wait a minute. If you mean the case interests me merely because of family matters...
No, I didn't mean that.
But you just said...
I only wanted to say that's how you know about the case at all. You were explaining to me how you got to know about it. Frankly, I wouldn't have expected you to be familiar with the present pop scene. I'm sorry if it sounded as if I meant to.
I'd get involved in the case, even if it was somebody else expecting his child. No matter who.
Oh, I know.
Well,
What do you think about my idea of writing some sort of protest?
Where did I leave my
briefcase?
Ah, yes, of course. I guess this is the sort of thing you had in mind. What? Here. What is it? Have a look.
Good Lord. Well. Now, isn't this marvelous? Marvelous! That's a laugh, isn't it? Good Lord! Here I was cuddling my brains about how to go about it. Finally, I take the plunge and consult you, and all the time you've had the whole thing wrapped up and ready. That's marvelous. I knew I was doing the right thing when I turned to you. No question about it. There, precisely what I had in mind. Brief, to the point, and yet emphatic. Manifestly the work of a professional. Oh, I'd be sweating over it for the whole day, and I'd never come up with anything remotely like this. Listen, just a small point. Here at the end, do you think willfulness is the right word to use? Couldn't you find a milder synonym, perhaps? Somehow seems a bit misplaced, you know. I mean, the whole text is composed in very measured, factual terms, and this word here suddenly sticks out, sounds too emotional. Would you agree? Otherwise, it's absolutely perfect. Maybe the second paragraph is somewhat superfluous. In fact, it's just a rehash of the first one, except for that reference here to Javurek's impact on nonconformist youth. Excellent. Well done. That must stay. How about putting it at the end instead of your willfulness? Would that do the trick? But these are just my personal impressions. Good heavens, why should you listen to what I have to say? On the whole, text is excellent, and no doubt it's going to hit the mark. Let me say again, Ferdinand, how much I admire you. Your knack for expressing the fundamental points of an issue while avoiding needless abuse is rare indeed in these parts.
Come on, you don't really mean
it. Great piece of work. Thank you for letting me see it. Here, you better put it back in your briefcase. Anyhow, it's good to know there's someone around who you always turn to and rely on in a case like this. Have you sent it off yet?
We're still collecting signatures.
How many have you got so far?
About 50.
50? Not bad. Never mind, I just missed the boat, that's all.
You haven't.
But the thing's already in hand, isn't it?
Yes, but it's still open, I mean.
All right, but now it's sure to be sent off and published, right? But, by the way, I wouldn't give it to any of the agencies if I were you. They'd only print an easily little news item, which was bound to be overlooked. Better hand it directly to one of the big European papers so the whole text gets published, including all the signatures.
I know.
Do they already know about it?
You mean the police?
Yes.
I don't think so.
Look here, I don't want to give you any advice, but it seems to me you ought to wrap it up as soon as possible, else they'll get wind of what's going on and they'll find a way of stopping it. 50 signatures should be enough. Besides, what counts is not the number of signatures, but their significance.
Each signature has its own significance.
Absolutely. But as far as publicity abroad is concerned, it is essential that some well-known names are represented, right? Has Pavel signed?
Yes.
Good. His name, no matter what one may think of him personally, does mean something in the world.
No question.
Listen, Ferdinand.
Yes?
There's one more thing I wanted to discuss with you. It's a bit delicate, though.
Oh.
Look here, I'm no millionaire, you know, but so far I've been able to manage.
Oh, good for you.
Well, I was thinking, I mean, I'd like to... Look, a lot of your friends have lost their jobs. I was thinking, would you be prepared to accept from me a certain sum of money?
That's very nice of you. Some of my friends, indeed, find themselves in a bit of a spot. But there are problems, you know, I mean, one is never quite sure how to go about it. Those who most need help are often the most reluctant to accept.
You won't be able to work miracles with what I can offer, but I expect there are situations where every penny counts. Takes out his wallet, removes two banknotes, hesitates, adds a third, hands them to Vanek. Here, please, a small offering.
Thank you very much. Let me thank you for all my friends.
Gracious, we've got to help each other out, don't we? Peanuts?
Not for me.
Incidentally, there's no need for you to mention this little contribution for me. I don't wish to erect a monument to myself. I'm sure you've gathered that much by now.
Yes. Again, many thanks.
Well, how about having a look at the garden?
Mr. Stanley?
Yes?
We'd like to send it off tomorrow.
What?
The protest.
Excellent.
good. The better, the sooner. The sooner, the better.
So that today there's still...
Today you should think about getting some sleep. That's the main thing. Don't forget you've a bit of a hangover from last night, and tomorrow is going to be a hard day for you.
I know. All I was going to say
was... Go straight home and unplug the phone. Elsa Landowski rings you up again, and heavens knows how you'll end up.
Yes, I know. There's only a few signatures I've still got to collect. It won't take long. All I was going to say, I hope you'll agree with me. I mean, don't you think it would be helpful? As a matter of fact, it would be sensational. After all, practically everybody's read your crash.
Oh, come on, Ferdinand. That was 15 years ago.
But it's never been forgotten.
What do you mean, sensational?
Well, I'm sorry. I had the impression you'd actually like to...
What?
Participate.
Participate? Wait a minute. Are you talking about the signatures? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
You mean I should...
I'm sorry, but I have the impression...
Good Lord, I'm going to have to get some more brandy. How about you?
No, thanks.
Suit yourself. Now, that's a laugh, isn't it?
What's a laugh?
For heaven's sake, can't you see how absurd it is, eh? I ask you over, hoping you might write something about Javert's case. You come here and produce a finished text. And what's more, one furnished with 50 signatures. Perverse, isn't it? What can one do? What can one do? Well, seems clear, doesn't it? In theory, that is. Everyone should start with himself. What? However, is this country inhabited by only one Bannex? It really doesn't seem that everybody can become a fighter for human rights.
Not everybody, no.
Where is it?
What?
The list of signatures, of course.
Mr. Stanley?
Yes?
Forgive me, but I'm sorry. I've suddenly had a funny feeling that perhaps...
What funny feeling?
I don't know. I feel very embarrassed. Well, it seems to me perhaps I wasn't being quite fair.
In what way?
Well, what I did. It was a bit of a con trick in a way.
What are you talking about?
I mean, first I let you talk, and only then I asked for your signature. I mean, after you're already sort of committed by what you've said before, you see...
Are you suggesting that if I'd known you were collecting signatures for Jurorik, I would have never started talking about it?
No, that's not what I mean.
Well, what do you mean?
How shall I put it?
Oh, come on. You mind I didn't organize the whole thing myself, is that it?
No, that's not...
What is it, then?
Well, it seems to me it would have been quite different matter if I'd come to you right away and asked for your signature. That way you wouldn't have had an option.
And why didn't you come to me right away, actually? Was it because you'd simply written me off in advance?
Well, I was thinking that in your position...
Ah, there you are, you see? Now it's becoming clear what you really think of me, isn't it? You think that because now and then one of my pieces happened to be shown on the television, I'm no longer capable of the simplest act of solidarity.
Ah, you misunderstand me. What I meant was...
Let me tell you something, Ferdinand. Look here. If I willy-nilly got used to the perverse idea that common decency and morality are the exclusive domain of the dissidents, then you willy-nilly got used to the same idea.